There are a few things we're going to talk about. We're going to go into greater detail about these things. But setting aside your own agenda and asking God what he wants to accomplish in this time. To not tell them, not tell somebody something when a question will do. We're going to talk a lot about questions. Part of permission is when someone begins to ask you questions. Very often that begins by you starting to ask them questions. So we're going to talk about the power of questions. We're going to have little discussions about what kind of questions would be effective in a particular time. And we're going to practice questions. One of the things that I do is I'm an executive coach. So I coach business people. It's very similar to discipling one-on-one or in groups. But people are willing to pay you for it if you help them succeed in their life and business. And one of the key aspects of being a coach is entering into a conversation as a learner, as a questioner, and to learn the art of powerful questions. And so we're going to practice that a bit here to learn to develop that within ourselves. One of the things that I love to say, I heard it from a guy up in Canada. He says, if anybody gets angry, you lose. In a conversation about God, if anybody gets angry, you lost. If you get angry, if they get angry. So essentially what we want to do is we want to win a friend the right to be able to have another conversation. I remember when I had been pursuing my wife to date, and she knew me when I was an angry atheist, and she was a new believer. And it took about 10 years before she would even consider dating me because she wanted to see if it really stuck when I came to faith, I think, to see if there was really any change. So it took me 10 years to grow enough to where she would take that risk. And I remember when I was dating her, inside of my mind I'm thinking, I just want another date. If I could just earn through this, not mess it up so I could get another date. There's a point where that actually began to create a lot of pressure, but in the beginning of that relationship, that was actually a good thing. In a conversation with someone, I very often try to be sometimes a little bit curious, to make them curious. I tend to be sometimes not answering all their questions. At times, even a little mysterious. Intriguing in some way. I'm not going to put a burden on you. There are simple ways to answer people's questions to find out if they want more information from you. And that is one of the ways that we're going to talk about from getting permission. How I got to permission evangelism, and I'll tell you this. When I came to faith, like I said, I had grown up, my family was supposed to be Christians. My dad wanted to be a pastor. My mom wanted to be a worship leader for his church. They met each other at Furman University, Baptist University back east. And then right before graduation, he decided he wanted to be a pilot. He went to Vietnam. My mother was not very happy about this. She had already committed to this vision for life. And his vision changed. He came back from Vietnam a very changed man with post-traumatic stress disorder. There was a lot of violence in our home. There was this idea that I had in my mind of God as somewhat schizophrenic because my dad would beat me purple when I was 4 and then 15 minutes later come back to the little kid crying and asking for forgiveness. Kind, gentle man. So I didn't really understand this idea of father. It was very much like I saw in the Bible. As I looked at the Bible, of a schizophrenic God who was really, really mean, this Old Testament God, and this really, really kind New Testament Jesus, and somewhere between Malachi and Matthew, he seemed to have gotten saved. And that was really, really difficult for me. It was very confusing. And then I would look at Christians, and I saw hypocrisy. And I looked at my own family, who were supposed to be Christians, and I saw hypocrisy. I saw divorce. I saw anger. I saw fighting. I saw abandonment. I saw pain. And I had come to a conclusion, and I'll tell more about my story later, that if I couldn't get people to love me, I'd force them to respect me. So I became successful in business. And then I realized that none of that fulfilled me. So I came to the end of myself through success, not through failure. And then I met her. And she asked me questions about me and what I believed and why I believed things. What did I base it on? And she didn't try to defend anything. She just said, I don't know, this is my story. And the fact that she didn't get into an intellectual argument with me, I saw something real in her that I couldn't refute. I couldn't argue with someone's personal experience. I had to deal with it. It was true for her. It wasn't true for me. It created a frustration. It created a hope. And I set about to prove Christianity false. 9 months later, I was a believer. And the way I got the permission of evangelism was I got very excited about this change that was happening in me. And about a year after I came to faith, maybe a year and a half, my company, my software company I worked for, moved me out to Utah to run a product division out there. So I was going to save Utah. I was going to save the Mormon church. So I studied. Oh, you cannot imagine what I studied. I have books and books and books on Mormonism. And I would read like old versions of the Book of Mormon and look at the differences between the old book and the new book, and it's been changed so many times. And I read so many things. I met with Mormons that had converted and would like grill them for hours. I learned apologetics. In the church that I went to in Atlanta where I came to faith, Ravi Zacharias would speak at my church. Dr. William Lane Craig, Bill Craig, if any of you know him, he did the God debates on NPR. His job is to write books of apologetics and to travel all over the world and debate famous atheists at universities. And so I would go to his house and hang out with him. I would go to his Bible studies and at church, and I would sit there and he would talk about philosophical arguments. There is no absolute truth. Do you believe that absolutely? And I would think, all right. And I'd go, all right, this is how you can get someone to say that sentence so that you can like beat them down with this other argument. Because who actually says there is no absolute truth except for a philosopher in a debate? And so I was constantly figuring out how could I manipulate a conversation to get somebody to say something that I had an answer to. So I was getting to be friends with some of these guys. We're in New York for some business deal. We closed this deal. We had this like real camaraderie. You know, you just guys, you know, went to war and they won, and we're sitting in our seats on the plane and we're talking, and we started talking about Mormonism. And I started talking about all the temple rituals, stuff I'm not supposed to know about. I started asking him questions. He didn't want to answer. And short time after that, didn't last long, he turned away, stopped talking to me. And this guy that had been becoming a friend of mine for months never spoke to me about faith again. I never, ever had another chance with him. My motives were right. I wanted to prove him wrong. I wasn't even trying to convict him of his own sin or anything like that. I just wanted to show him what truth was. I never had another chance. And I was so distraught because I liked this guy. And God had given me like this. Sometimes, have you noticed God sometimes gives you this compassion for somebody's heart? And you're like, why do I care so much about that person? And not this other person over here. He turned something on in me to where it just broke my heart. I actually cried for this guy. I wasn't a big crier back then. And for days I prayed about this. And I thought, God, what is it? How can I reach Jim? How can I reach Mormons? And there was this amazing moment where I felt, I was journaling, and I just felt like God was kind of writing through my hand. And he said, Jim's not a Mormon. And that other guy in the development department, he's not a Hindu. And those other two guys are not Muslims. And your sister, she's not agnostic. And you weren't an atheist. And I said, what is that? He said, there's just people who don't know grace. They don't understand it. That makes sense to them. I looked up grace in the dictionary. It's not anything very interesting. It just seems kind of scientific. Almost mathematical. This plus this, you end up this. And it came to me that grace is experiential. Grace is about a person engaging with another person, changing a person. But it changes each of us in a completely unique way. And the person you're talking to, you can talk about the theological, forgiveness of sins, cleansing of sins, all of that, which is an important thing to talk about. But the way it will impact that person is completely and totally unique. What God rescues that person from will feel different than what He rescues you from. And I said, so what do I do with this? And I felt like God was saying, you need to figure out how to tell the story of grace. Your grace, the grace you received. And in that way, you'll be able to communicate to anybody. It doesn't matter if they're a Muslim or a Mormon or an atheist. You've learned all these arguments for all these different kinds of beliefs. But there's only really one kind of person if they haven't experienced Christ. There's someone who doesn't understand grace. My goal changed, and I found this recently. My goal is probably a bit more like this. And has been for quite some time. Greg Kuchel. Actually, he has if you can go on the web and look for him, he has some really great resources for Christian convictions in discussing that. My goal is modest. I want to put a stone in a person's shoe. I want to get him thinking. I want him to consider listening to Jesus first before dismissing him. If I can simply open that door, I have accomplished something important. So, putting a stone in somebody's shoe is giving them something to think about. The process. As a coach, one of the things that I do with people is I determine how God designed that person. What is their thought process? Some people think very quickly. Some people need days to process information. That may not happen in your coffee at Starbucks with them. They may have to process this. Right? It could be months. So how can you set the door open? Open a door and say, hey, I'm a person that you can talk about spiritual things with that's safe, and when you're ready to do that, you know where I am. But not put a timeline on. As God began to talk to me about permission evangelism, I started to see that in the corporate world, as well as in education or any type of government job, I was able to talk to anybody about my faith because they asked. This is a little loophole, especially if you're a school teacher or something like that. A little loophole in the law is that if a student asks, you can tell them anything. You can answer their question. You can talk about faith. You can pray with someone to receive Christ right in your classroom, as long as they ask. Permission evangelism is about getting that person, if they're ready, to ask you, probably through your story. And what's interesting is that when you think about putting a pebble in someone's shoe, it's usually leaving them with a question, not an answer. It's a whole lot easier to leave someone with a question than an answer, isn't it? I can ask a question, I don't even have to have the answer. I can just see that question is theirs, and I help them articulate it. And then, guess what? The Holy Spirit drives them nuts. Keeps them up at night. Completely bugs them. One thing about permission evangelism, which came to me through, the story's in the book. I was teaching some people about marketing technique, because I was in charge of marketing for some software, and I was talking to them about this relationship building and how you give the person you're doing business with a little bit of something, and they give you something. And they make a decision, the thing that you want to give me is worth this much of my personal information. Right? Well, this is something you're all familiar with on the web. You know, they always want a little bit of your personal information. You're faced with this decision every single day you're on the internet. How much information am I going to give them? Is the risk greater than my desire for this thing? Or is it less? You're faced with this decision constantly online. But in all of marketing, it's the same way. And I was talking to people about how do we build these relationships? How do we get information so people will give us feedback on our products, as well as how to design things specific for them, as well as maybe introducing us to their friends. They give us permission to be able to do this because we give them something of value. It's not just selling our product, but it's building that relationship. So more and more and more, as trust grows, they give us a little bit more. And I was explaining this, and something just hit me that, oh my gosh, this is evangelism. This is building trust so that you can then tell them or give them what you really want to give them, and they get you to that. They get you to that point. And part of it is, like I said earlier, expecting God to be in there, but also knowing that you can walk away because you have some certain criteria of, is God guiding this conversation forward? And I'm going to give you how that works. Dr. Craig, and this is he also has some great resources online. He wrote a book called Reasonable Faith, which is a fabulous book. This is the guy I used to sit in his classes all the time. He says, we can present a defense for the Christian faith without becoming defensive. We can present arguments for Christianity without becoming argumentative. Now, this is a guy that's famous for apologetics. What's the definition of apologetics? Defending the faith. Which really, does that really sound appealing to you? Defending the faith. It sounds like this position, I mean, if you look at apologia, if you look at the original word, that's how we talk about it. But it doesn't really seem like a real appealing thing. And when we look at people who say, I'm an apologist, they're people who are masters at gathering information, and they're masters at arguing. They're masters at basically taking a lawyer's approach, philosopher's approach, and it's difficult for us. This guy, William Craig, he's this really brilliant, amazing guy. He has a degenerative disease that degenerates his muscles. So he's actually this somewhat small, frail guy with this amazing mind. So he approaches these situations with these very aggressive atheists, like the guy that Jurassic Park movie and book was modeled after, where they're a great goal in the world. Richard Dawkins is one of those kinds of guys. And Bill Craig would approach them with kindness and gentleness. He would give an answer for what he believes, 1 Peter 3:15, and he would respect that person. And I said, Bill, how many of these people have come to faith in all the decades that you've been doing this? He said, to my knowledge, none. And I said, why do you do it? He said, I don't do it for them. He said, I don't just do it for them. But every time I do this, there's a crowd of people who have questions. And I said, what do you think makes the biggest difference? He said, well, from what I've heard of people, the fact that I'm the only one on stage that doesn't seem to be angry or condescending. I don't feel like I don't look like I'm losing anything when somebody makes an argument against my faith. He told me some things that really touched my heart. This guy is willing to put himself up against all these greatest minds in the world so other people can see the heart of God through him. That blew me away. I thought it was all about the argument. And I realized I got really good at some of these arguments. And I won them most of the time. I thought I won them all, actually. But just like with Jim on the plane, what did I win? We're going to talk about when apologetics is appropriate. If someone has a particular intellectual barrier, you can help them with that intellectual barrier. But what I learned is probably not lead with apologetics, not lead with an argument. Lead with a question and be willing to walk away. And this is some of the feedback that people have given. I've been a Christian for 12 years. I've always struggled with evangelism, being effective at it. Even though I've been ministering in the church for that long, this is the first time that I've ever had hope to actually being successful at it. I pray that some of these words may be your words at the end of this. And I promise tomorrow I won't be talking as much as I'm talking now. I'm going to go through a few things real quick. Excuse my really sad graphics here. I just didn't really put a lot of effort into that, but hopefully the content. You know, this is familiar, isn't it? So I'm with the Navigators. One of the things that I do is with the Navigators in Russia. My wife's been there for 14 years. I've been there for 6 years. We learned all those things, drawing on napkins, evangelism explosion, all these different types of things. And this argument worked really well. You know, you're here, God's over there, and your sin's in the middle. I've changed this a bit. If people are asking, how do I get to God? You know, we would say there's this chasm between you. I would say, really, in people's hearts, there's this quest for purpose, value, and meaning. And in the situation when they have a childhood or cultural history with the church, some of these arguments might work. Some of these questions might work. Do you know for sure that you're going to be with God in heaven? If God were to ask you, why should I let you in my heaven, what would you say? This is evangelism explosion. How this normally worked, especially in previous generations, is you'd invite someone to church. Salvation would usually happen in here or some kind of event with a group. There'd be some emotion involved, some information involved, and then through the church, you have this healthy, growing relationship with God. One of the dilemmas in those early days, let's say, well, not terribly early, 70s to the 90s, surveys, when people have done this, like when Willow Creek got started, they went out and did these surveys. And these are the words that people said, this is what we thought about church. It's boring, irrelevant, music is bad, I don't want to dress up, they want my money, this kind of stuff. So, a lot of churches design themselves around being contrary to this. Much more casual, different hours, you know, we got a box in the back, we don't pass a plate, these kind of things. Now you look at surveys. What do people say about church? It's not about the program. It's about the attitudes and the hearts of the people and how they relate. Those people are closed-minded. Those people are judgmental. Those people are hypocrites. What they do there is clearly irrelevant. Very often today's seeker, if a person is on a journey, and as a coach, I always talk to people about, where do you want to go? You know, people that aren't on a journey don't really want to go anywhere. They have no need for a coach. So I'm not going to meet with them. Same thing with evangelism, to some degree. A lot of times the question right now is how to become a better person. And this quest for purpose, value, and meaning, they either have a non-existent experience in church or they have a negative experience in church. And I use the word church just to, not as the real church, but there's some type of religious something that they were involved in, which they will use the word church. What they want to be is this, not judgmental, open to all ideas, not a hypocrite, not exclusionary, which is the antithesis of their definition of a Christian. What do you do with that? What happens to believers? Because they don't relate. They go, well, we need to be together. And if we do evangelism, we'll do it as a group. Or we'll leave it to the experts. I'll invite them to church and let the church do all that for me. I'll bring them to an event. We invite people. We'll go on a mission trip. Very often, we don't sit around with each other and say, I just had this conversation with this person. I didn't really know the answer to their question. I didn't know how to respond. I don't think it went very well. Do you have any idea what I could have done better? How do you approach this? We don't work together to share our mind and our experience. And very often we think, I don't, you know, like that pastor. When we did door-to-door evangelism that I scheduled, I was praying as I walked through the door they wouldn't be home. So why'd you do door-to-door evangelism? Not that it's wrong, but why were you doing it at that moment with that heart? One of the things I want to get to is that I want all of us to see our story, your story, as the most amazing miracle that has ever occurred. Equally to any other miracle you've ever heard. So, what was Jesus' approach? It was interesting to me. I didn't study the Bible or anything until I was like 27 years old, 26. And I looked at these parables. And I'm learning evangelism. I say, oh, let's just look at Jesus' way. So he did miracles. Drew a big crowd. Oh, well, I thought, I can't do that. So I need to draw a big crowd. So I'll come up with another way to draw a big crowd. I ended up being on the board of a ministry that taught people how to draw big crowds at churches. And then he would tell them parables. Have you read these things? So try this for your evangelism. We're going to do an event to get tons of people, hundreds of people there. And then as soon as we get them all there and get them all excited, we're going to tell them confusing stories that have no answers. Try that next time. Isn't that a little weird? He told them parables. Even the people that lived with him didn't get it. What on earth was his motivation for doing this? Why on earth would you draw a huge crowd and then confuse them? Could be. He taught people. When he mostly taught his disciples in the presence of other people. People that were with him all the time. And if other people happened to pick it up, great. What was really interesting, I started to think about this. And I thought, if that's the way Jesus did it, maybe there's a model in there for me. I was pretty good at confusing people. But the miracle thing has kind of slipped by me. God's path. Anybody want to read John 14:6 for me? Anybody have it? John 14:6.
Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me.
What about, 14:6. Thanks. What about John 16:28? I came from the Father and entered the world. Now I'm leaving the world and going back to the Father. Okay? Forget what you know about theology. That's confusing. It was almost the same breath. It was the same city. He's talking to them and saying, no one comes to the Father except through me. See you later. I'm gone. Out of here. What do you do with that? Hidden inside, in between those two things, he says, and I will ask the Father, and he will give you another counselor to be with you forever. The Spirit of Truth. He talks about many, many times, especially John 13 through 17, he talks about, as the Father has loved me, so I love you. As I love you, so you love one another. He talks about the Spirit will guide you into all truth. The Spirit will remind you of everything I had told you. People are drawn to the Spirit of God. So God, Jesus left. People come through Him. He left. He left His Spirit with you. And don't get stuck on this theologically. Could it be that the model is that people will come to faith through the Spirit in you? I say don't get stuck on it theologically because it is the Spirit of God that will save them. But could it be that they will be drawn to the Spirit in you? The whole model is exactly how they got drawn to Jesus. It's the same way they're going to be drawn to you. So what does that Spirit look like to them? I think that Spirit is the passion of God, the love of God. As God had loved Jesus, so He loved them. As Jesus has loved you, so you love one another. There's a really interesting thing. I thought about what is, if this is about a healthy relationship with God, you know, Jesus says, you'll do greater things than I did. Right? And he talks about this heart connection. As I am one, you will be one. We'll all be one together. And being one, as I got married late in life, still radically changed me. I started to understand this sharing of passion. There's a definition I thought about a long time of what is a healthy relationship. I like this definition. A healthy relationship is an ever-increasing knowledge of each other. Have you ever been like at a Denny's or a Waffle House or something? You're sitting there having dinner and you see this couple. Look like they've been married a long time. They order their food. They sit there and eat that food. They get up and leave, and they never said a word to each other. Not one word. They just ran out of words. Somewhere along the line, that person stopped being interesting to the other person. There's no questions to ask. There's no information to get. Somebody decided that there's nothing left to know. But I guarantee you, they're both thinking about stuff. The other one doesn't know what they're thinking. They're both feeling stuff that they haven't asked questions about. What's really healthy about a relationship, as long as you're constantly growing in knowledge of that person, because people are changing all the time. We're all changing. You're constantly growing fresher and newer and closer with each other. So I think about, God knows everything there is to know about me. If I want to have a healthy relationship with God, me growing in my knowledge of Him and His heart and His passions is really one of the best ways to understand Him. So what is God's greatest passion? Read the story of the pearl, the lost coin, the lost sheep. Says that there'll be dancing in heaven at the salvation of a single soul. Dancing. A party. The party in heaven. Excitement. The prodigal son. Amazing thing. Amazing party that happened in a celebration. This is a passion that if we feel a sense of dread for evangelism, our perspective somehow needs tweaking because it's not connecting with the passion of our lover, of our God. And so I see, and this is, you know, you may bristle at this a little bit. I want to know God more. I want to understand a little bit more about His passions. My wife used to think I was nuts because I like to ride bicycles up ridiculously steep hills. She's like, why do you want to do this? Why do you spend your money on that stuff? And I said, just try it. Just try it. I knew her. I knew she'd like it. And she got out there and she's like, wow, this is like worship. I just feel so free, so connected. Or whatever words she wants to say. But she actually said those words. It's like worship for her. She connected to a passion of me. She knows so much more about me now. Because I have this passion, even if she chose not to do it like I do it, just the fact that she would want to know about it and connect with it. Just connects us in a deep way. So, to be able to share in our lover's greatest passion connects us to him. And I believe I gain so much by the knowledge of him and the knowledge of his heart. And when he gets excited, I get excited. And you know what? It's somewhat self-serving. I like it a lot. And I get excited in anticipation of those kinds of things. I have to tell you, I'm not an evangelist by nature. My wife, she's an evangelist. She'll talk to anybody. I have plenty of stories where God has given me great opportunities. And I just didn't want to talk to someone. And I ignore them. And they come back, and they come back. And I was on a plane one time going to do one of these workshops in Iowa. And I'm reading this book, this popular book, Seven People Who Meet in Heaven. This lady starts talking to me about this book. And I didn't really talk to her, so I said something really quick and set it off. She brought up something again, something about heaven and God. And I just really like kind of ignored her. I put headphones in. Then we get off the plane. We go to baggage claim. She's standing next to me at baggage claim. Get my bag and I leave. I go out to the rental car place. She's standing next to me at the rental car place. I didn't talk to her. Still didn't talk to her. I just didn't want to. It's not my nature. And I knew that God wanted to do something in my heart that day. And he awakened me to my resistance to being used. And he gave me another opportunity. Not with that woman, but I became much more aware. I became more heightened to what was happening inside of me when I felt that resistance. And instead of feeling like I have to have a conversation with her, I now have a conversation with him. What's happening inside of me right now? Why do I not want to talk to her? And you know what? I'm much more open to having those conversations when I begin a conversation with him. But I have to tell you, I'm not naturally a person. I'm a person who'd like to have an argument with you. But I'm not necessarily the person who really wants to just openly talk about the gospel all the time. I've grown in a way to be able to have hundreds of conversations. And I've had people, through permission evangelism, who I thought that didn't go anywhere, 8 months later, walk into my office and say, "Hey, a little while ago, you told me something about, you know, about God, or you said that you had some kind of experience. What was that about?" And I think, what happened? And it's really interesting. That particular girl, her father died 30 days earlier, coming into my office. And she started to have questions, spiritual questions, questions about God, questions about the afterlife. And she thought, "I need answers. But I'm not going to a church." That's how she felt from her experience. Where can I go for answers? Well, this guy seemed to have some kind of spiritual experience, but he didn't shove his beliefs down my throat. Maybe I can talk to him. About 8 months later, actually, we had these conversations. She moved to Europe. I went to work for another company. I hired her, brought her back, and about a year later, she came to faith. And her story's in the book, and I told my side of it, and I told her side of it. She told her side of it, actually. One thing I want to talk about is part of permission evangelism is understanding the non-believer, respecting them and respecting their journey, where they happen to be right now. Discerning the Holy Spirit, and then creating an atmosphere where they invite you in. So, I talked a little bit about the don't understand grace, but think about this. What's interesting about a Christian who has been trained to tell the gospel? What's different between you, not just your beliefs, what's different between your attitude of that conversation and a non-believer? You're trained to tell the gospel. You trained to know what you believe. You got your little things you're going to say. And you're talking to someone who doesn't believe that. What's some of the differences in the emotions that you two have? Any thoughts? Or is that too abstract a question?
If the believer is trained, then they're probably more confident going into this conversation.
Yeah, that's right, Morgan. They're much more confident. Yeah. Now, if someone is a trained, let's say they're a Mormon, they went to BYU, they did their two-year mission, they're pretty well trained to talk about what they want to talk about. Jehovah's Witness, probably pretty well trained. A devout Muslim, pretty well trained. They're willing to sit and talk to you about theological issues, different perspectives on God. How many people do you know in your current life that are really committed to a particular religious belief that aren't Christians? How many? Anybody know? One? Five? Anybody have five people? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven of you. No, five people that are committed in a particular belief. There's a lot of people in this room. That's not much. But you know a lot more than five people. You know a lot of people. Most people, what? They don't really know what they believe. Isn't that true? They just don't know what they believe. It was really interesting when I went over to my wife's house when she was a new believer and she wouldn't date me. And I, of course, was quite arrogant and completely confused why she would not want to date me, of all people. Now I have many reasons. And I wonder why she's married to me right now. But so I was like over there, and it came out that, you know what? Well, when we went over to I think it was the dessert place or something like that, and something about God came out. I have no idea. I'm sure she like brought it up. And I just went off for 20 minutes on how stupid Christians are, and they're weak, and they have to have this crutch, and they believe in these fables just to get them through the day. And I just can't believe that intelligent people would choose to believe in such fiction. And of course, I then repeated all this other stuff that people said about, well, there's so many contradictions in the Bible, and it was written so long ago, and there's so many different translations, and all these denominations. You know, no one can even agree on this stuff. And she wouldn't return my calls anymore. And I'm like really confused. I mean, I'm a nice guy. Thanks for playing. And so one day I actually showed up at her house and knocked on the door. I really liked her. I showed up and I started asking, you know, like her questions about her faith and this and that. She said, well, you know, I can't date you because, you know, she didn't say idiot, but I sensed it kind of in her heart. She was thinking, how, you're just not healthy for me. And so we started, I started asking her questions, this and that, and this and that, and this and that, and that went on for a long time. And then she actually turned around to me and she goes, so what do you believe? Well, I believe this and this and this and this, and I believe in the Big Bang Theory, and I believe this and that. And I threw out some scientific stuff. She goes, what do you base that on? And I started to talk about it, and as it was coming out of my mouth, there was this voice inside my head going, that's not holding water. That sounds really dumb. I don't believe me when I started to say it out loud. But you know what? No one had ever asked me. I had tons of conversations with believers, but no one ever asked me. And I convicted myself of my ignorance. I didn't need anybody else's arguments because I was really good at being on the attack, but I wasn't really good at introspection. So when you present to someone, this is the way it is, it's just like this, it's so simple, some people are going to feel stupid. They just don't know what they believe. You got it all sorted out. And this is a big question. And then, think about this. What I believe about God is a very personal thing. It's related to fear, insecurity, me not knowing something, ignorance. Why would I talk to you about something I haven't figured out yet and I feel really insecure about it? What makes someone share with another person something that will expose their personal fears, insecurities, and ignorance? What does that? What helps you when you want to share with someone your insecurities, fears, and ignorance? What leads you to that freedom? To be that intimate with someone? What's that? Yeah, that's really good. That is. When someone's willing to do that for you. I always say that if you want a 1 on a scale of 1 to 10 of real personal, intimate stuff, truth, on a truth scale, if you want a 1, you better give them a 5. You want a 5, you better give them a 10. And not expect that they're going to give you exactly what you gave them. So when we have a little script, a little thing that we do, how personal is that? When it's your own story, and you say, you know what? These are the things I struggled with. These are the things I struggle with now. These are the questions I have that are still left unanswered. What freedom does that give somebody? Because guess what? You're talking to someone. The ultimate goal is you want this person to realize that what they believe is not true. Mistake. They have a mistake in their understanding. And that they have to then change their belief to believe something else. They have to realize, I'm wrong, I have to believe something else, and my life will change, I have to choose this. It's all about change. Everything's about change. It's about wanting to change. It's about seeing your life lacking in some way, in your present, your past, your hope for the future, and then choosing to move somewhere else. So I got to first admit something's lacking. I don't understand something. I missed it. You got it sorted out. And now I have to do this. So the greatest way to do that is to, one, say, all we're going to talk about in the stories is, I used to believe this. Even if you accepted Christ when you popped out of the womb, there has been a time when you believed something about God and you realized you were wrong. And you thought, you know what? He's not exactly who I thought he was. I bet you every single person in here has a story like that. Whether you want to admit it or not, admitting it may be the absolute best thing you can do for someone. To say, you know, I don't have this life story of this massive sin before I came to faith, because, you know, there's so much you can do before you're 4 years old. but there was this time when I was 36, and I really thought that I had to perform in a certain way to get God's love. I had to be a certain kind of person so that He would love me. And that was more connected to my father. The fact that I never really received from him what I really desired. And very gently, through some specific events, God revealed to me that that wasn't true. That that wasn't who He was. And I've realized there's many, many things that I have to relearn about God because of that. And I'm learning some of those things right now. What was in that story? What was in that little piece, a little snippet of my life? Vulnerability, genuineness. What about process? What was in a process there?
thought one way, mm-hmm. realized you needed to change. Mm-hmm. Now you're starting to begin to understand. Mm-hmm. Still don't have it all figured out.
Still a process. So there was a process, there was a before, there was a process, there was an after that is continuing in process. You know, one thing non-believers hate so much about Christians is they have all the answers. Do you hear this? You hear it? Do you ever read like CNN blogs or NPR blogs?
No.
Yeah, a lot of you probably don't, just because it's so infuriating sometimes. But I read it sometimes. I see an article and I go and I read these blogs and I just want to know what people are thinking. I want to know how they're communicating. I really want to. And it used to really infuriate me. Now it just makes me really sad. Because I see such consistency in wrong information. And it makes me sad. Sometimes I get mad, but mostly sad. And so think about the gospel. What Christians are strange, first of all, like the word fellowship. I mean, how many times do we use this? Sorry if you use it a lot. But fellowship. Other than Tolkien novels, how often is this actually used in general conversation? In America, if you're not a Christian, we're going for fellowship. We had great fellowship on Sunday. We were over at John's house, and we have dinner there every week, and just really amazing fellowship. What does this mean? You have a definition of this, right? You understand. You've been trained to talk and understand what fellowship means. Other people just think, this is Christian language. I don't understand that. What about, think about, if you've never gone to church before, that accepted Christ. It's a simple thing. When you think about it, it's a little weird. Accepted Christ. Now, you can reason and say, well, that shouldn't be weird, but just the saying of it is weird. Now, think about the gospel. And we're going to talk about this. Hey, you know, tonight, you're going to have to endure me just standing here because I have to get all this out, so tomorrow we can do groups. But tomorrow, we're really going to be interactive. We're going to have groups, right? And people are going to share, and you're going to talk. And but I have to just, like, get some stuff off just my chest at this point. But think about the gospel. So, God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son to be shamed and brutalized and killed so that you also can be firstborn children of that same God. No thanks. Look what you do to your most beloved Son. I don't want that. So the few problems, and these are problems like people in Russia really awaken. If they have no Christian training at all, and you're in Russia, and someone says, I didn't want Jesus to die. I wouldn't want anybody to die for me. That's just wrong. One person actually said, well, he wanted to. That wasn't a sacrifice. He wanted to. Nobody does anything they don't want to do. You could show them Garden of Gethsemane and all this other stuff, but that's their mindset. So, all right, so this God who's so loving abandoned His Son so I can be His son or His daughter. When you step back from your own social indoctrination and your own baptism in the gospel, I mean, you're soaking in it for years. It's just strange. It's a little bit weird. Thus making you weird. You're a little strange because you believe this. To be able to help people and talk about the gospel, one of the ways we're going to talk tomorrow is, what if someone has an intellectual issue? How much you talk to them. What if someone's issue is hope? What if someone's issue is purpose in life? What's the gospel message for that person? I went to a conference one time, a Navigator conference, and some guy, it was just like, it was this shtick, he was this little thing. He would walk up and go, what's the good news in Russia? You know, it was a little annoying, but he made me think, actually. He really made me think, and I thought, well, the good news is, and I was like trying to come up with Well, it's a, you know, my wife and I say in America, very much it was a guilt culture. You know, I did bad. In Russia, it's a shame culture. I am bad because everybody's guilty. Everybody breaks the law. It's just part of the culture. America's becoming more of a shame culture because there's less guilt. And so, you know, we would talk about that. And, you know, it's all true. But the reality is when you get into the individual people, the good news for one person is different than the good news for another. The good news for Ira is that there is a father who really loves you and won't abandon you and won't lie to you. The good news for Maxime is you don't have to be afraid anymore. You can be a man. You can have what it takes to lead your family. The good news for Sasha is even without a father that you grew up with, you have the best father ever, and he'll show you how to raise your kids. That was his good news. Everybody's good news is a little bit different at different stages in their life. And the gospel doesn't seem so strange in that, as long as it always leads to Jesus. So, when people ask, are you a Christian? Let's say you're at a coffee shop. You're sitting down, you have a little thing, and someone sees what you're reading, and you know, you're reading Permission Evangelism. And they go, are you a Christian? What's your answer?
Define Christian.
That's really good. I don't think there's been a single time, I'm probably wrong, there's probably been some times, but I can't remember a single time since I came to faith in 1992 that when asked that question, I've answered yes. Am I ashamed of my faith? No, not in the least. We just have different definitions most of the time. Somebody asked, I remember sitting in this coffee shop I used to go to every morning with my dog. My dog was really popular there. Greatest evangelism tool I've ever had. It was a dog who was well-trained and pretty and well-behaved. Because everyone would say, hey, where's Maggie today? They didn't even know my name half the time. They knew my dog. So she made a lot of introductions for me, but I would end up in conversations with people because they'd see there, they pet my dog, and they'd end up talking to me. And people would say, so, you know, they'd see I'm reading, or what do you do for a living, that kind of thing. And we're going to get to how to work through those kind of questions, especially if you're a pastor or in ministry. And people go, oh, great, thanks. And they move on because they really don't want to talk to you. When someone asks me this question, I will just look at them and say, what's your definition of a Christian? I'm not sure, is what I'll say. I'm not sure. What's your definition of a Christian? And they usually start off really good. They say, well, you believe in God and Jesus, and you believe in the Bible, and you believe that gay people are evil, and that you can't dance or listen to rock and roll music, and that these people are bad, and, you know, just really, somewhere in there, they stop answering my question, and they start talking about their, you know, issues. And I would say, you know, the only people who have ever been offended by that question, what's your definition of a Christian, are Christians. I've never had a non-believer offended by that question. They answer it. Christians look at me and they go, well, what Christian is this? And I go, oh, well. Glad you're so convinced. But the non-believers, they answer this question, and something changes often in their answer is they start just telling me all their issues. And I'll say, by that definition, no. I would not. I would say people who believe that would not consider me a Christian. And sometimes they go, there's like this sigh of relief that they can actually have a conversation with me because I'm not this. But you know what? What they just revealed to me all their issues, all their stuff. And I know exactly how to talk to them now. I know how to. It's a simple thing. I just didn't answer their question. I didn't ask them anything. I just didn't answer their question. But sometimes I would say, you know what? I used to believe Christians were like that. But I had an experience, you know, about, gosh, 20 years ago, that really challenged my perception. And there are people a lot like that. But I realized that for me to believe in God, I didn't have to believe those things. I didn't have to be that way. To repeat that? Well, I would say to someone, I used to believe something, you know, related to what you, but something happened to me, or I had an experience a certain amount of years ago that really challenged that belief, and now I believe something different. You would think so.
I mean, some do. Why?
Some of them don't.
Yeah.
Some of them really don't. You know, and you're kind of surprised. You're like, gosh, you just left that hanging?
They really don't care.
They really don't care. They just really don't care. I've actually thought, in the moment, I thought it was from God. And I thought, oh, this person, gosh, I see this person, and I think, I really got to share the gospel with this person. And then they go, hey, why'd you move to Phoenix? To work for a software company. I mean, Phoenix doesn't have a software industry much. It's a few companies. I said, well, I actually wanted to be involved in this nonprofit organization that was based in Phoenix. It was really, you know, something that was real valuable in my life. And I found the software company that would move me down here and let me work there so I could work with this nonprofit. And they go, oh, okay, cool. And I'm like, I was going to share the gospel with this person. They don't even care to know the basic thing about my life that I think is somewhat important. They could care less. And what if I wanted to go tell them about Jesus? And I would just skipped over that whole like qualifying point of, do you even care that I'm breathing? You know? And they really much didn't. They were just making small talk. And I honestly wanted to share Jesus with this person, and I thought this was the moment. A lot of times, we miss this person's perspective. We very much miss their definitions of words. We have very different definitions. I think one of the biggest things is in determining whether someone's ready to talk to me about something. That something, I need to know what they... If we're using the same words, the same ideas, the same definitions for those words. If their idea of Christian is one thing, if their idea of God is one thing, if their idea of whatever, church is one thing. And very often, I can say, oh, that's your definition? Well, I have a different perspective on that. And they might be interested in engaging in that. Or you might find common ground. We're going to talk tomorrow about questions of what do you believe, right? Questions we can ask people. What do you believe? How did you come to that conclusion? It's just asking more information. Wow, that's interesting. How did you come to that conclusion of all the different options to believe the thing that you believe? And the where questions are about you helping them take a step further in their belief, finding some common ground, and then moving them to another place. And it may be beginning where they are, but it may be going somewhere else. And we're going to go into detail about that tomorrow. We're going to talk about God's job and our job. And their words. But right now I'm going to talk about their role once they come to faith. But right now I'm going to talk about questions. I love this quote from Francis Schaeffer. If I had only 1 hour with someone, I would spend 55 minutes asking them questions. And 5 minutes trying to say something that would speak to their spiritual situation, their unique spiritual situations. Francis Schaeffer was a brilliant guy. He had a lot to say. He had a lot of thoughts, a lot of ideas. In fact, when I went to go prove Christianity false, I went to a secular bookstore, I thought, and I went to the shelf on religion, and I thought I pulled the scientific book off that was to refute the existence of God, and somehow God confused me in the process, and it was a Francis Schaeffer book called The God Who Was There. And I got through like several chapters before I figured out he was a Christian. I mean, some kind of great density in my mind that was happening at that point. That I think God just confused me. But I ended up reading this book going, wow, there are some really smart Christians. I had no idea. Who could have thought? Who could have thought that these people actually were intelligent? And then someone introduced me to C.S. Lewis. And I'm thinking, they're all smarter than I am. They're like, there's tons of these people who are brilliant. And I don't get it. Then I meet William Craig. I meet all these other people, and I realize they're really, really bright. But the thing is, if somebody who knew as much as Francis Schaeffer would spend that much of his time, 90% of a conversation asking questions, and 5 minutes in an hour speaking, I think there's something we can learn there. One of the things I love to think about in questions is, never make a statement when a question will do. How could you ask a question in lieu of the thing that you're trying to say? Never make a statement when a question will do. Sometimes a question will not do. Somebody asks you a specific question, but you know what? Very often, there's a question for a question. What did Jesus do? People ask him a question. Should we pay taxes to Caesar? How did he respond? A lot of these things, Jesus responded with questions. There's some Campus Crusade people who are very passionate folks in St. Petersburg and just love their heart. I was meeting with a couple of guys at this coffee shop, kind of talking about our ministries and what was going on. And I just related this story about this girl, Nika, who we just love and adore. And she asked my wife, she'd been in our community for a while, she asked my wife, she goes, I want that peace. How do I become a Christian? And I could see these guys at the table like leaning over, like, did you pray with her? Did you pray with her? I said, well, my wife, and correct me if I'm wrong, honey, she said, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to become a Christian? Why do you want to pray? She didn't pray with her. Because her answer told her that there wasn't real true conviction of sin. There wasn't a desire to turn from anything. Repent. Turn and go the other way. There wasn't this need for a Savior. There was need for peace. Praying a prayer wouldn't have gotten her there because her heart wasn't ready. But a year later, she came to Susan and said, last night I prayed. Something really real happened to me. Susan asked a question when it was the best thing, much better than an answer. This is a little graph. Again, not a fancy graph. But we're talking about the people that you encounter in discerning if they're willing to engage in a conversation about the gospel. Most people, when you first talk to some folks, you say a lot of people are just uninterested in spirituality. There are people that are interested in spiritual topics. They probably number greater than the people who are ready to walk through the doors of your church. There are people, probably less people, who are interested in spiritual, just general topics, to talk about topics, of open to hearing about your personal experiences. Want to know you, not just information. Something about the name of Jesus changes conversations. There's a lot more freedom in talking about God. You can talk to God about with Muslims and Jews. You can talk to God with Hindus and Buddhists. You can talk the word God with a lot of people. You can find some common ground in that. When you mention the word Jesus, some things change. I'm not saying avoid any of these things. I'm saying work your way through them logically to determine if someone is willing to go that next step. In ways that you engage in those kind of spiritual conversations, I mentioned before, there are some trigger words. So I had a spiritual experience, 10 years ago that really changed my perspective on being a man and what it means to be a man. Or anything. I had a spiritual experience. And there are plenty of people who say, oh, really, what was that spiritual experience? Because Christians don't use that word. Christians say, when I accepted Christ in 1992, but I had a spiritual... Was it a spiritual experience? I certainly hope so. Because if not, we need to talk a little later. But I had a life-changing experience. I had a spiritual experience. I had a change in belief. I discovered that I was really wrong about some things. I used to think that way too, but I had an experience that changed my perspective. Instead of, I'm an administrator at Park City Presbyterian Church, I work with an organization that helps people find real value in their life. Really, what's that organization? You can actually expose more about your heart and the purpose before you actually give a name. Oh, I work in a church. Great. So, could you pass the salt? The process of permission and what we're going to talk about, the goal is to get you to your story. But get you to telling your story to the people that really want to hear it. So we connect to a conversation with leading statements. Hopefully you got here through asking questions of other people. We're going to talk a lot about that tomorrow. But you're talking about processes of change. So I want you to think about this tonight. As we go through this, I want you to think, tomorrow we're going to get in groups, we're going to talk about this. You can do it tomorrow in the groups, but if you have time to think about it, and maybe even pray, that God would reveal to you the maybe three specific milestones in your life that something changed in your belief system or in your person. Right? And probably a change in belief was directly related to a change in your person. So what changed in your life at certain times? Maybe in relating to God and how that affected relating to other people. So what were three major milestones in your faith journey? Think about that. Tomorrow we're going to get in groups and we're going to talk about that. So somebody asked me a question. So why'd you move to Phoenix? Right? I don't live there anymore, but why'd you move to Phoenix? I was involved in a nonprofit organization. Then I really valued the work that they did, and I found a job that allowed me to move there. So they have the option to opt out of that conversation in a moment. Choose themselves out by not asking a question. And they may then choose themselves back in. Many people choose themselves out at that point. And then somebody feels like they don't really have a purpose or something's happening or they just kind of wonder or they just finally reach the point where they choose to trust me and want to know a little bit more about me and they go, hey, what's that nonprofit that you were working with? Honestly, this has happened. This has happened many, many times. And then I would say, this is not necessarily a change, but it's actually an organization that... helps people come to an understanding of God that is a real personal thing and not a big religious thing. Really? How do you do that? What's the difference between God and religion? A whole bunch of questions people can have at that point. Well, I used to believe that anybody who believed in God was... really caught up in just a bunch of rules and regulations, and that's really what that was all about. But I had an experience that completely changed my perspective many years ago, but I've never been the same ever since. A lot of people may choose out at that point. Other people may say, really, what was that experience? Maybe I haven't introduced God at that point, and I would say, you know, it may sound kind of strange, but it was an experience with God. And that used to always be strange for me, but it's not strange for me to talk about it anymore, but at the time it was really kind of weird. And people go, really? What was that? But I don't give them the gospel or something at that moment. And I'll just move through this, and I'll say, well, they'll say, what happened to you, you know, that many years ago? And I begin to tell my story, and I tell little pieces of it. I say, you know, it's kind of a personal story, but I'm happy to tell you if you really want to know. And I have had so many people say, oh, no, if it's too personal, you don't have to tell me. They apologize for asking me to tell them about Jesus. And I'll say, no, it would be my honor to tell you. You know, but it's the real thing. I mean, it's me. I'm going to tell you the truth about me. So what happens in that situation? What happens when someone reaches that point and they go, oh, you know, if it's real personal, I mean, I'd like to hear, but is that manipulative? That's the truth. I'm going to give them the real deal. Do they want it? I don't see it as manipulative. I just see it as discerning. And I believe that if they walk away and they go, you know, I don't really want to know that or something like that, they know that I'm willing to give it to them. And one day they'll come back. I've had many, many people come back. And I'll have a conversation on an airplane, and I'll get somewhere through there. I'll give someone my business card, and we just chat about something else, and I'll get an email. I got an email, was it 4 years ago? And it said, 4 years ago, yeah. Michael, I don't know if you remember me or not, but I was the director of IT at this company, and one night you took the time to tell me about Jesus, to open my eyes to Jesus. I'm Jewish, as you recall, but I've been walking with Christ for the last 6 years. That was 4 years after I had that conversation with him. And of all the people that are involved in the link of the chain, he somehow chose to write me. That's really cool. That's really, really cool. And I know I just told him something changed in me. I had changes of thought, changes of behavior, and then a change of my being. Something in me dramatically changed. And then people tell me ask those questions. And then I tell them my story. But why do I tell them my story? Do I tell them my story to give them information? Some. The real purpose, I tell them my story, I want to create an atmosphere. I want to give them the opportunity to make a decision for Christ. But I really want to know their story. Their decision to choose Christ or not choose Christ, to follow God, is not based on my story or any information I give them. It's based on their perceived need. I want to know their story because I may begin the conversation spiritually about me, but I'm going to end it with them. That's where we want to go. And it's really important, I think, in that telling of your story, to be able to lay out the tools for salvation. A pastor friend of mine had the next door neighbors over. And right after, they were talking, they said, hey, what do you do? Well, I'm a pastor. Well, how'd you become a pastor? You know, when you were working on an oil rig in the North Sea, and you became a Christian and became a pastor. So he told the story, and a couple minutes, they changed the subject. A month later, This woman who's next door neighbor said, "Hey, can I meet with you?" The night after we had dinner at your house, I went home and prayed. I'd never heard the gospel before. I went home and I prayed, and something really changed in me. And now there's problems in my marriage because my husband's seeing these changes for the last month. She hadn't been discipled, didn't read the Bible, didn't do anything. But in this two-minute conversation, he gave her enough information that she wanted to make a decision. It's not a formula. He just said in his story, weave throughout, what the elements were. And she did that, and now she said, "I need help." That was pretty significant. One thing about stories in church. Oh, I'll stop in just a sec. One thing about stories in church is that we have a tendency to celebrate the dramatic. I'm sorry for that. It saddens me, actually. We put up the person in a dramatic life change. The gangbanger, the drug addict, the wife beater, the guy who left prison, and we put him up on stage. Or we put the missionary up on stage. And people go, "Wow, I wish I had a story like that." No, you don't. You really, really don't want that story. But that's what we celebrate. And we don't know how to tell the story of, you know what? When I was 5 years old, it just made sense to me. I didn't know much, but it made sense to me. And I know that God has saved me from living a life without love. He saved me from making choices that would have destroyed my life. I remember in high school this one time when I was invited to do something and I stopped short, and I really believe that was God. And I'd have a very different story today if it wasn't for me knowing Him all this time. And through the years, I've gotten to know His heart, and I really feel like I can talk to people about who He is and what is this love of this God that for so many people seems so distant but so near to me. And I love talking about Him. And I think everybody can know Him like that. I think that's what He wants. That's a story of a 4-year-old convert, 5-year-old convert. That's not the story of someone that I was this terrible, evil person, and now I'm different. And the last story, and this will set up for tomorrow, is the last story I want to tell you is that I was in this ministry and I was helping people with their stories, and they go, "Oh, you got to get Jeffrey to tell you his story." This big hulking guy in the room. He was running this ministry. It was an evangelism ministry. And we got to the point of this thing where we were doing stories, and so we asked for Jeffrey's story, and he started talking, and the whole room was like, he was, you know, abused as a child, became a, you know, really reckless kind of guy, Chippendales dancer. I mean, he was doing drugs. He was a professional bodybuilder. He would drive 150 miles an hour on his motorcycle and then lift his hands off of the handlebars. And I mean, he got drug under a truck after a fight. And I mean, the stuff that he would tell you, the conclusion of any believer, a non-believer, would be, "I'm glad you found Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad or Hare Krishna or anything that would just get you off the street, because you were scary. You were a scary man. And I'm so glad that you found what you needed." And his story went like this. He told all this stuff, 25 minutes, 30 minutes into it. He said, "And then, when I was laying in the hospital bed, this girl came to visit me, and she told me the story, and I believed it was true, and I prayed, and within 6 months, I quit my job, I moved out to Seattle, and became a youth pastor. And everything's been different ever since." 30 minutes of my sin, my scary life, about a minute or 2 minutes of my process in a sentence about my future. I don't believe this is helpful. We're often told about this, our pre-Christ story, our process, and then what happens after Christ. I would venture to say that the best way to do this, I think of it as opening, cracking a bunch of doors in a hallway of my past and turning on a light. I let them know a whole bunch of little things that I used to have this really wrong idea of what a father was because of my father. The result of that is that I lived really a life of insecurity, fear, and I really felt alone. I set up some of these things, and then we talk about the processes a little bit longer, and then we talk a lot about what happened after God. When I asked Jeffrey, I said, Jeffrey, could you summarize your life before Christ in one sentence and one emotion? 30 minutes, he talked. He goes, well, I grew up in a really dysfunctional family. And the result of that is that I became a very angry man that hurt a lot of people. I said, now, describe your process in a sentence and how a person affected that. So, well, I kind of came to the end of everything that I tried to satisfy in my life, and I met this girl who said that God had completely changed her life, and she had this hope that I hungered for, and she talked to me about Jesus, and it changed me. Maybe that's two sentences. So how did you come to faith? Man, how did you come to that faith? And then what happened afterwards? What's your hope for the future? What's the impact of God in your life? And he said, well, I realized that God had been pursuing me my entire life. But I realized the essence of sin was I was taking for myself what he was not giving me. I was choosing to do what I thought was right and what I thought was satisfying me. And I chose to relinquish that to God, and I asked for his forgiveness. And my life didn't completely change overnight, but I believe something in me changed. And I said, and now what's your hope for the future? I mentioned that. What's your hope for the future? He said, you know what? I began to forgive those people that had hurt me, and I began to forgive myself for hurting others. And right now I know that there is no way for the rest of my life that I'll ever live alone again. I may be physically alone, but I'll never truly be alone. And I'll never be without love. And then Jeffrey, the kind of guy, a couple years later, he had a baby. He had this amazing story. He'd really been focusing for a couple years on the impact of God in his life and began to focus his story on his view of the future, his belief of the future, how the present in God, how he changed his past, and how he saw the future different. And I saw him, I was there the day his first child was born. He was holding this baby, and he started to cry. I said, what's up? And he said, it stops here. It stops here. The generational sin, I know, as the first believer in my family, it stops here. He can tell his story to anybody. And he can relate to them. You know, the common denominator for all people is emotion. It's not the facts. The facts of your story will never match exactly with anybody's. But how many emotions are there really? I mean, you can list A bunch. You say two. I'd say, you know, some people would probably say five or something like that. But there's, who has not experienced fear? Who has not experienced loneliness? Who has not experienced anger? Who has not experienced distrust? Who has not experienced hope? Love is a word that's really weird, and everybody has different definitions of it. But some of these other words are real deep connections. And you know what? If you can translate your story into a transition and an emotion, you can relate to anybody. And tomorrow, I'm not going to talk as much. And I'm going to let you talk, and we're going to go through stories, and we're going to share those stories. So, with that, I'm going to pray and let you guys go. Because we're over and I'm not going to take any questions tonight, but bring them in the morning and we'll talk. Father, I just really thank you for the miracle that salvation is, and that every person here who has your Spirit is part of the greatest miracle that has ever existed. And I pray, Father, that we will understand tomorrow how that miracle will draw people, whether it's a crowd of one or a crowd of many, and that we'll learn how to tell our story in a way as Jesus told parables, to sift people and to discern who's ready to learn about Scripture and learn about you. So, Father, give us a contemplative night or morning. Help us to connect with your heart. And I pray if there's anything you want to say to any of us in the time between now and when we meet, that you would not allow Satan or our own thoughts or fears to get in the way of that. In Christ's name I pray. Amen. I'm certainly open for questions after as well, so anybody who wants to chat, you can chat with me.